Welcome to the Hands-On Business Podcast, the place you come to get tips, tricks, and advice on growing your business. As you know, this is a podcast where you can hear real business leaders discussing systems and methodologies that they've actually used in their own business to help them catapult growth. My name is Hakeem Adebiyi, and I've grown several small businesses to multi-million pound enterprises, and I've noticed when I was doing that, and I still notice, that there isn't really any place that focused on where I was, i.e. growing a small business. All the content that was out there seemed to be about big business and often just a lot of theory and no practical, implementable advice. So I focus on getting people onto the show who are not theorists. They are people doing what you want to do and not just talking about doing it, so you can get real actionable takeaways which you can implement immediately into your business. Today, I was delighted to have Chris Hurst on the show. Now, Chris is an author of No Bullshit Leadership, which won the Business Book Award in 2020. Chris started life as an engineer, but quickly decided it wasn't for him and moved into advertising. He talks about how he went from some of his darkest days as MD of a business to being revitalized when he went to Harvard Business School and then becoming a CEO and turning around that business with some of the tactics he discusses in this podcast. Chris is now a widely recognized innovative and inspirational speaker and leader with a proven track record of transformation. So get ready for an informative and enjoyable podcast with absolutely no bullshit. It's a real pleasure to be joined today by Chris Hurst, author of No Bullshit Leadership, one of the simplest but most practical leadership books I've ever read. So it's not a surprise it was Business Book Awards winner in 2020. Now, obviously, I'm going to let Chris talk about how he went from engineering into advertising and then moving through to being an author and CEO of Havas Creative. All I know is that I was given this book as a gift, and now I use it as a simple reference guide in lots of areas when implementing or discussing leadership. Now, today, what we're going to be talking about and getting into is the art of getting from where you are today to where you want to be. And as Chris said, this is effectively what leaders are employed to do. And he also says that it's not complicated, but difficult. So obviously, we're going to get into that because generally things that are complicated are difficult, but we'll discuss that in more detail. Yeah. So welcome, Chris.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on. Delighted to be here.
Excellent. So let's start with your backstory. So how have you gone from being an engineer to moving into advertising, and then now you're a leadership expert known for your track record of transformational change?
Well, basically, I think at school, probably still even now, I think I'm quite an academic person. And by that, what I mean is I'm one of those people that quite likes the process of being taught. Some people don't, but I do. I like being taught and I like the process of learning. So that meant, that meant that school worked pretty well for me because that's what school is. So basically, I ended up as A level doing pure maths, applied maths and physics at A level. Once you do those at A level, that pretty well limits your opportunity, your options at university. So I therefore did engineering at university. And what happened was I was actually sponsored through university by a company called Pilkington Glass, who is a very big company still in St. Helens in the Northwest. So I actually worked for a year in a factory in St. Helens for them before going to university. I then went to university and did a 4-year degree in engineering. So by the time I finished university, it's 5 years, which is, quite a long time. And I found my degree really extremely difficult. I mean, I really, really found it a very, 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 very difficult. And so basically, honestly, it's maybe not a very exciting answer, but it's the true answer that I got to the end of those 5 years. And the one thing I knew for certain, having done engineering for 5 years, was I didn't want to be an engineer. Basically, the one thing I learned for sure. So I knew what I didn't want to do. I didn't really know what I did want to do, but I think looking back on it pretty well, I chose something that in my mind was as far away from engineering as I could imagine and find. And that was advertising.
And in terms of advertising, because I have this discussion a lot with people, advertising, marketing, sales, yeah, people yeah. think it's, oh, you just got the gift of the gab, so you're all right. But you just said that you're very academic. You're obviously quite structured if you did engineering.
Yeah.
How did you then marry those two things up? You know, what did you see in advertising that was attractive?
Well, what I saw, honestly, I think what I saw was it was just a very, very, you know, I worked in a factory as with the apprentices. They had lots of apprentices, so I did lots of kind of really quite interesting stuff. Learned to weld, heavy current engineering, heavy current electrical engineering, that kind of stuff, which was really kind of fun and really interesting. But I just thought I don't want this to be my job. And if I look at the jobs here, I don't want to do these jobs. So it was more, I ended up doing advertising as a reaction against something else rather than because I sat and thought, oh, wow, I just so desperately want to work in advertising. I mean, it was honestly never that. And maybe like a lot of kids, you know, I think the world's different now, but certainly maybe then, I mean, I grew up in rural Northumberland. I think I had quite a sheltered upbringing. At 18 or even at 22, my perspective on what jobs, what constituted a job was really very narrow. You know, I mean, I could go and work in a factory. I could be a lawyer, I could be a doctor, I could be, you know, a policeman, I could, you know, I mean, literally the sort of things you read in kind of Ladybird books. And so it wasn't until I kind of right at the end of my degree that I thought I'm going to start to try and explore some of these other places. And I honestly think I went to a presentation that Saatchi & Saatchi did, and I thought, that looks fun. And it doesn't look like a factory. Yeah, I'll apply there. I mean, I didn't get a job at Saatchi & Saatchi, but in the end, I did get a job at an agency. And, it was no more scientific than that.
Okay, that makes sense. And then obviously you moved on. Because you're now obviously the CEO of Havas Creative. So what was the reason for the shift from, I suppose, I guess, advertising into consultancy and leadership development and thought leadership?
Well, my day job is very much running an agency network. I mean, that's my day job. And so I suppose in that sense, obviously my job is bigger than it was when I started, but based broadly, I'm in the same industry. I mean, the businesses that we have within Havas Creative, you know, span a large section of the marketing services spectrum. So it's not just creative agencies, there's PR agencies, management consultancies, you know, design businesses within there. So my job now is more about kind of, I suppose, making the whole greater than the sum of the parts, really. And I think then the leadership piece, I think it started off like a lot of things in life, kind of bit by chance. You know, I was asked to do a presentation to some graduates on leadership. And I thought to myself, okay, great, I'll do that. And like a lot of us do, right? 2 days before the presentation, I thought, oh, hang on, I better work out what I'm going to say. And I thought, what can I say that isn't just the same old blah, blah, blah? You know, I mean, what can I say that they haven't heard before? If I'm going to go and talk to them, how can I say something new and useful to them? And so it started from that. I did the presentation. It was fine. And then I kind of came back and I sort of woke up in bed on a Saturday morning, and I had just this thought came into my head, no bullshit leadership. And I thought, that's an interesting idea, but I don't know whether it's, you know, an article, a long paper, or a book. And until I sit down and try and actually write it, I'm not going to know the answer. So that's what I did. And I think the two things sit extremely comfortably together. In fact, I mean, my primary task now is about how I create an environment that my business outperforms its competitors. That is my job now. And that in my opinion, is the primary and defining task for a leader.
I found that really interesting in the book when you were talking about that, that, you know, and we're going to get into the behaviors, the values and all that sort of good stuff and the culture. And you're basically saying that actually culture is the only thing that you can't replicate. That is your, or it should be your competitive advantage. And it's interesting because the way you talk about it, anyone who reads it will recognize what people do. And I thought the example of Enron was perfect. You know, one of their first their first value was integrity. You think,
exactly. How does that work then? Exactly.
So just on that, because obviously you went to Harvard Business School, and I haven't been to Harvard Business School, but I have a feeling that they probably don't take the same view as the no bullshit leadership. So have you gone from that, or is it very similar?
It's actually, I think, in their defense, it's a lot less formulaic, or it's a lot less kind of traditional than I thought it was going to be. But I'll be honest, I mean, I was lucky to go, and I went at a point in my life and my career where really it was a real low point in my career. You know, I really was at a really shitty point, and I got lucky to go, and I got lucky to go at that exact time, and it really did change my life. But it changed my life, like as I said, by the way, as I said at the start, I'm quite an academic person, so I like people teaching me things. So you're at Harvard and you just kind of wallow in being taught things. It's you know, and if you like that, it's fantastic. You know, it's really, really just fun, particularly given there's no exams at the end. So it's actually, strangely enough, you almost get more out of it because you're not always worrying about, oh, I've got to go and revise this and do the exam. You can just enjoy it. The reason it changed my life wasn't because of anything that they particularly taught me. It was more sort of contextual. So I went at a personal career, personal low point. And the way it works is it's 8 weeks. It's very intensive. It's 6 days a week, late nights. You know, it's very team-based. You live and work with these small teams of people. You're in Boston, so you know you're a long way from your friends, your family, your job. You 6 days a week, so you haven't got time to be dipping into your day job, and the consequence of that is that when you walk into the lecture theater, there's about 80 people in the lecture theater, and you're told where to sit. So it's very, very regimented. You're told where to sit. You go and sit there, and you realize that when you walk into that room, nobody has the faintest idea who you are. You don't have the faintest idea who anybody else is. And in truth, you can be anybody you want to be when you walk into that room. You can tell them anything. You know, you could be anything. And all that stuff you've got in your head, which is like, or certainly I had in my head, which was, you know, like my career's gone shit, the business I'm involved in, you know, I've been there for too long, it's not working out. What am I going to do with my career? What am I going to do with life? All this narrative that I've got in my head that's really dominating me. Suddenly, I just think nobody here knows any of that. Nobody gives a shit about any of that. I could just be anybody. And so, that's a very liberating feeling because, you know, all of us have got that stuff all the time, right? All the time. And of course, when you come back, you know, your kind of everyday life, your normal life gradually reintrudes, let's say. But for me, even though some of that stuff came back, I never quite went back to where I was before because I can always remember that feeling of kind of liberation, if that makes sense. And so strangely, the thing it did for me was more that than any particular thing I was taught, even though I did enjoy it very much.
Excellent. So, I mean, there's a couple of things you just said in there and it resonates because obviously people say, and you said it as well in your book, that you learn a lot more from failure, or you can learn as much from failure as you do from successes. Mm-hmm. And you just said that when you went to Harvard, you were talking about your career low point. So, yeah. I mean, that's really useful for the listeners just to get a sense of, so what was happening there? Because people look at you as you are now, successful, yeah. your leadership. Yeah. So people are thinking, well, he could never have had any low points because he's just, he just knows yeah. about leadership. He's yeah. always been great. So what was happening there?
Well, so that's definitely not the case. I think everybody, by the way, has low points. Well, I think they do. What happened was I'd had a pretty good career. I joined advertising. You know, I was pretty good at it, and I was hired in my early 30s. I was probably about 32, so I was pretty young, and I was hired as part of a kind of hotshot new leadership group to turn around what was a shitty agency. So this is about 2003. So it's a long time ago now. So I was hired as part of this leadership group, and we were going to fix this agency that was considered by the industry to be unfixable. Okay. It was like a dog of a business. Forget it. And we all joined, and there was five of us, I think, and we kind of knew each other a bit, and we rated each other. We looked around the group and we thought, like, you know, this, we're pretty good. Like we're gonna sort this out, no problem. And within about 6 months, the guy that had hired us, he'd been fired that's a story in itself. So he'd gone, and then, you know, not too long afterwards, various of the other people that I joined with gradually left, and by the way, went on to have absolutely stellar careers and still having stellar careers. And I, for various reasons, stayed. And after about 6 years, after 6 years at this agency, I'd been passed over at least. I was the managing director, not the CEO. I worked for the CEO, so I'd been passed over at least twice to be the CEO. So they'd said to me twice, like, you're not the right person to do the job. We're going to hire somebody else. The agency was still a shit business. So after you've been there for 6 years, if you're hired as part of the solution, and if you're still there 6 years later and it's no better, you become part of the problem. Mm. They made it clear that they didn't think I was right to take the top job. And by the way, I actually, even though it pissed me off, I think they were probably right. And so I got to a point where I thought, well, you know, I've kind of screwed my career. I mean, I don't know where this goes. You know, I joined as part of the solution. I'm now part of the problem. I'm associated with this crappy business. I'm kind of, you know, I'm associated with failure without redemption. You know, there's not a redemption story here. What am I going to do? And I had, you know, I got to the point where I felt like I'm just going to have the courage to step out and go and try and create, just walk away from it and try and create space, and therefore create space for new opportunities to come along. But it's, you know, it's easy to sit here and say that. But of course, by that point, I'm not in my early 30s anymore. I'm in my late 30s, and I've got mortgage and kids and all those other things, you know, that make those kind of decisions. They're easy in practice, but on paper they're very, you know, they're easy in theory, but in practice they're very, very difficult. So that, I mean, that was failure by any measure, and actually it was fairly public failure, and it was quite protracted failure essentially. So Harvard came along pretty well just at that point.
So two questions there. So first one is, so how did you get out of that? Mm. Harvard was obviously part of that solution. Yeah. And then the second one was, bearing in mind, because obviously that's a learning experience, knowing what you know now, what would you pinpoint as being the reason why it wasn't as successful as you'd hoped?
So the answer to the first question is that I came back from Harvard, a sort of, you know, comparatively, to an extent, a bit of a new person. You know, I was... new energy, new determination. But by the way, I came back determined to leave. I mean, I came back 100% like, okay, I got all this knowledge, I've got this behind me, great. I, you know, it's still a bit scary, but, you know, big wide world, here I come. And they had just hired another new CEO. And so again, had not given me the job, had just hired another new CEO. And not too long after I got back, but try and keep the story simple, his boss retired and he got given that a bigger job, basically. So he gets given a bigger job. And he then has a decision to make, which is what to do. Does he pass me over again? Am I going to stay? Is he going to offer me the job as the CEO? And he did. He offered me the job as a CEO. And, you know, honestly, I think I was pretty lucky. I mean, I'd like to turn it into a really kind of, really sort of sophisticated sort of parable, but I can't. I think I was pretty lucky. And I think he took a bit of a chance in doing that. But that is what happened. So therefore, you know, in the space of probably 9 months ish, you know, I get passed over again. I decide in my head, it's time to leave. I go to Harvard, I come back, a vacancy arrives, I get given the opportunity. And really that's how it went. So yeah, that's how it went.
Okay.
I can't remember the second part of the question.
Yeah. The second part was just about it. Knowing what you know now, could you pinpoint
why
the reason for the lack of success? Yeah.
So I think there's inevitably a number of different reasons. So I'll answer it from my perspective, because I was, you know, I wasn't the CEO. So I wasn't in charge, but right. I was part of a leadership team. But nevertheless, to speak from a personal perspective, I would say that in reality, I didn't know what I was doing. That is the honest answer to that question. I didn't know what I was doing. I didn't know how to go about getting us to where we wanted to get to. And probably I lacked the confidence and all sorts of other things that go with that. But that is without question the best summary I can come up with. And I think actually it's a great question, because I've told people that version of this story. I've told this story lots and lots of times, but nobody's ever asked me that question before. So why was it a failure? And I think what's in answering it, one of the things that occurs to me is I almost wonder whether, you know, to fast forward to writing the book, whether on some sort of subconscious level, you know, the book comes out of that failure. That makes
sense. So because you just said it's difficult but not complicated, which is, and that's the theme that runs through the book.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Just explain what you mean by that then, because generally things that are difficult are complicated, or things that are complicated are difficult.
Yeah. Yeah. I think what I mean is that the principles of leadership. So what leadership is. So for example, you know, what leadership is. What are the things you need to do it well? They aren't complicated things to understand. You know, I think I can explain to you what it is pretty simply. But actually doing those things in the real world and making a success of them are difficult to do. I mean, they aren't easy. So for example, you mentioned at the start, you mentioned culture. I think culture is probably the best example of that, but I mean, you could pick others. But, you know, I think that there is so much bullshit talked about culture. Honestly, it's ridiculous. But for me, culture is the environment you create in an organizational sense. Culture is the environment you create as the leader in order for your teams to outperform either the competition. And it's not always, you know, it's not always a competition. You could argue that might be in a hospital. Every environment where people are working together has a culture, you know, a school, a hospital, an advertising agency, you know, a police force, you know, whatever, whether it be four people or a million and a half people like there are in the NHS, right? They have a culture. And your ambition as the leader is so the question is that culture a good culture, a bad culture, a helpful culture, a toxic culture? Your ambition as the leader is to create an environment that enables your team to either outperform the competition if it's a competitive in context, or to achieve things that they wouldn't otherwise have achieved if you weren't there. I mean, that's, you know, that you might say that, like, I don't know, in a sports team or whatever.
Yeah.
That's a pretty that is a pretty easy to understand thing, right?
Yeah.
But the obvious, if you said it to somebody, the obvious next question is, okay, yeah, I get that. How? How do I do that? and that starts to get difficult because people are, you know, people are complicated, difficult. You know, managing people is hard. It's a lot to do with people. You know, you have to align the ambitions of individuals with the ambitions of the group. I mean, there's all sorts of logistical challenges. I mean, to take an extreme example, I don't know how many people work at the NHS. I don't know, whatever it is. What are they? The second biggest employer in the world or something crazy. And it's like a million people. I mean, you know, you don't need to go to Harvard Business School to work out that trying to, you know, influence an organization of that scale and their behaviors is going to be difficult, right? So I think that's what I mean.
Okay, so that makes sense, and because I want to get into that just in a bit actually, in terms of the culture, because I mean, one thing, you know, Peter Drucker says that culture eats strategy for breakfast. Which I really like that quote. What does that mean then? Is that effectively just saying that actually it doesn't matter what you do if you haven't got the right culture, then you're not going to be successful? Is that what that's basically saying?
I think what he said for me, if you create, as you know, when I sat down and wrote the book, I thought if I'm going to write a book about leadership, I have to define for myself firstly, and for anybody that writes it, what I mean when I use certain words. What do I mean when I say leader? What do I mean when I say leadership? What do I mean when I say culture? So for culture, you know, that my definition is an environment the leader creates in order for their teams to outperform. If you accept that definition, then I think it makes perfect sense of Drucker's quote, because if your teams are outperforming, then, you know, that's what you're there to do. I mean, you know, that's it. That's the task. So I think he's just making a point that says, you know what, if you've got an effective culture that allows your teams to outperform, everything is just that bit easier, that bit easier, frankly, you know, and you're that bit more likely to succeed. I think that's what he's saying. I don't think he's saying you don't need strategy. I mean, when we were at Gray, for example, you know, we were turning that business around and it was starting to, you know, things were starting to work and people would ask us, so, you know, what's your strategy? What are you doing? And we'd say, well, our strategy is our culture. And by that, what we meant was we more than anything else focused on trying to create a really effective culture, because in an effective culture, people achieve things that they wouldn't otherwise achieve.
Mm.
I mean, that is what happens, and we've all been there. Okay, so we've all of us have experienced that, because all of us, either ourselves or have seen other people, but I would argue probably ourselves, we've been in an environment where we work in one team or in one company, and we feel and behave in a certain way. And then we change and we move to another team or a different company and we feel and behave in a different way, whether that be better or worse. You know, you go from zero to hero or hero to zero, and you're the same person. I'm the same person. It's the environment that's changed.
Yeah.
I've just delivered the manuscript for my next book, and I found this fantastic. Kind of quote. There's this. There's a guy called Professor Gohal, or Goshal, I think his name is, and he sadly he died quite young. But he was um, he was a professor. He was born in Kolkata, and he was professor of business school at INSEAD, and he was professor of at London Business School, and he was an expert on organizational culture. And he told this story. He said, I grew up in Calcutta, and in the it's a wonderful city, and I take my kids back there every year, but we have to go back because my kids are at school. We have to go back in July. Okay. And he said, it's a wonderful city in spring. It's a wonderful city in autumn. It's a wonderful city in winter. When I go back in July, it's 103 degrees. It's like 90 degrees humidity. And I just feel tired all the time. You know, I feel exhausted. And then I go home, and he worked at INSEAD, which is near Fontainebleau Forest in France. And he said, I'd go home to France. I'd go back to France, and I'd go for a walk in the forest in Fontainebleau. And he said, you can't walk in the forest in Fontainebleau. You, the energy of the forest makes you want to run, makes you want to jump, makes you want to sing, makes you want to, you know, grab things. And he said, what so many companies do is they create an environment within them that is like Calcutta in July rather than Fontainebleau in spring. And he said, I'm the same person walking through the forest or when I'm, when I'm at home, but it's the environment that changes, and organizations do that. And then they complain that people have no energy. People aren't taking initiative. People aren't, trying hard enough. And that's because they've created that wrong environment. And I think that's a really nice way of thinking about how culture affects everything about us.
Yeah, so that's a really good analogy, actually.
Yeah,
because it is true. It's exactly the same thing happened. I remember going to Dubai.
Yeah.
And I think the first time I went in summer, and it was like 50, 60 degrees.
Yeah.
And we went on a little walk.
Yeah.
And I was like, we're stopping every 5 minutes, getting into the shops because it was so hot. And then we went back again, I think, in something like December, and we did the same trip. And I said to my wife, I said, if it's the same distance, because all of a sudden you can walk with energy, etc. So it's exactly the same thing. You're the same person. It's exactly the same. The journey you're taking, but the environment is different, and it kills you.
Exactly. And I mean, look, we're recording this, right? We're in the middle of a heat wave, right? I mean, just look at how droopy we all feel right now, And I think that for me is why culture is so incredibly, incredibly important. I mean, if you do nothing else, if you create that kind of environment as a leader, that I think it's a leader's superpower. I really do.
Yeah. No, I'll definitely agree. I think that any business that I've worked in that haven't performed is generally because of the culture. And as you say, where you see high performance. I mean, I don't think it's always 100% the case, but generally where you see high performance, the culture is a culture that people want to join and enjoy being in there. Because I think, as you said in the book, that if we're all in the business of talent acquisition, and if you have not created the right culture, that talent is going to go elsewhere sooner or later, which then affects the culture. Yeah.
I mean, there's no question about that. But I think culture is a complicated thing, because I think we'd all like to, of course, work somewhere that we enjoy, that's warm and friendly and all those kind of things. But I think effective cultures don't have to be that. I'm not arguing that they shouldn't be it. I'm just saying that each organization has to decide what culture is the culture they need in order for them to outperform. Now, if people don't want to work in that culture, it isn't going to enable them to outperform. I mean, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. Yeah. I mean, you know, if people don't want to be in it, it's not going to work. I think that good organizations and good teams manage to find a way of, for the individuals within them, or at least the majority of individuals within them, to align their own kind of personal ambitions with the ambitions of the whole. It doesn't mean that everybody's like obsessively thinking about work all the time. It means that the people in those teams think, I can see what the team is trying to achieve, and I can see what's in it for me being part of that team. You know, yeah. I can see that, you know, because quite often you can be in a team and you can think, I get why the boss wants us all to do that or whatever it is. But, you know, what's in it for me? What do I get out of it? You know, and I think that answer to that question, what's in it for me, is different for all of us. It's not always, particularly, I think, not these days, it's not always, I want to get promoted or I want more money. You know, a lot of people have far more, I think, varied careers these days than maybe they did 10 years ago. But nevertheless, you can still find ways for people to feel, I can see what's in it for me to be part of this. And some of that, of course, includes I'm getting, you know, emotional reward as well as functional reward. You know, I'm whether that be I'm enjoying it, I like the people, I'm learning things, you know, I'm getting exposure to opportunities I wouldn't have before, and a myriad of other stuff. But I think I imagine a really effective team. You know, if you get like iron filings on a piece of paper and you hold a magnet under the piece of paper and the iron filings all kind of line up in sort of, you know, semicircles, I kind of imagine that's how good teams work. And bad teams, you move the magnet and it's just a mush, you know.
And that's so one of the things that you talk about is in terms of trying to change that culture, and I'll come on to take an action because I thought that was an interesting concept as well, above everything else. Yeah. You said that you should take action quickly to change it. And are you talking about putting in totems?
Yes.
I think, the examples you gave in your business were about desegregating, where people sat. So can you just talk a bit more about what you mean by totems and some other examples?
I think people, you know, I mean, most people accept that culture is important. I mean, it's not that, like I said, it's difficult, but it's not complicated. Not much of this is new news. But what people do, I do find people say to me is, they'll say, Chris, like I know culture is important, but you know, it takes, but people sometimes say, but it's almost impossible to change. Or they'll say, it takes years and years and years to change. And I think neither of those things are true. I think it's difficult, but I think you can change it. And I think you can change quite quickly. And I can't remember if I used this example in the book or not, but you know, I do imagine culture like if you pour concrete, okay, you have a mold, like a path or something that you're making, and you create a mold out of wood and you pour the concrete into the mold. And of course, when you pour it, it's wet and you can kind of sign your name in it and, you know, stuff like that. But over time, that concrete sets. Okay, so it becomes hard. And I think that's what happens with culture. And then if you want to change that path, you have to take hard physical actions to do so. You know, you can't change culture by just having fresh fruit at lunchtime. I mean, it's perfectly nice having fresh fruit at lunchtime, but I don't think that changes your culture. So I think you have to take hard physical actions. And hard physical actions are things that I think that culture is a sort of a driver of our behaviors. So the culture influences how we behave. And also culture is kind of sustained through our behaviors. It's a kind of a sort of a cyclical thing. The best way to understand why the culture is what it is it's the behavior of leadership. So if you want to change that culture, you as a leader have to maybe you're new, in which case you bring a set of new behaviors anyway, or maybe you're in place already, in which case you have to identify the kind of behaviors, which is why I think behaviors are so much more important and so much more useful when understanding culture than values are. You have to define what you want those kind of defining behaviors of culture to be. So I think that's the first thing. Now, I think then, though, when you change anything, I imagine it a bit like kind of like freeing a sledge that's stuck in ice. Okay, so you have a sledge that's stuck in ice, and the first thing you have to do is you have to kind of kick, scream, shout, kick, smash. Try and fight to get this sledge out of the ice. Once you've got it out of the ice, you still have to work hard to keep pushing it along, but it's a bit easier. But the first thing you have to do is you have to free it. And I think that's the thing with change. First thing, you have to create this sense of change is going to happen. It's going to happen quickly. The future is going to be different to the past. So it's difficult to give examples in abstract, but because every situation is different. But I think you can do that by actually, you can make big changes by doing quite small things, I think, when it comes to culture. So for example, I always like talking about seating plans. I think where people sit and how people sit in an organization tell you a lot about that organizational culture. You know, are people in open plan? Are people in offices? Do people sit in departments? You know, I don't know, blah, blah. Is there lots of shared space? Does everybody have their own desk? All sorts of things like that. And if you want to create some, first of all, change, you change how you use your environment. But most importantly, think about the behaviors that you want to define your culture and think, how does my environment, how can I use the environment to enforce and remind and sort of drive forward that that culture? But there's a myriad, honestly, of ways of doing it. And I think you have to just define what those behaviors are. But the most important thing is culture is the behavior of leadership. So the most powerful determinant of culture is not what you write down or you tell other people or anything like that. The single most important factor is how you as a leader behave. And that applies whether you've got a team of 5 people or a team of 50,000 people.
That's really useful. I found that was I've never actually really thought about seating plans, because I promise you go into business and then you see it. Yeah, that's a bit strange. Yeah. You never really think that, oh, it's an issue. But when I read it, I was thinking, that's a good point. I was thinking of all the business I've worked in. You know, finance is over there.
Yeah.
Marketing's there. Yeah. Et cetera. You're thinking, how's that going to drive cross-functional working then? Because you're all in silos.
And there's always, I think with anything, there's always reasons not to change things. Okay, so you can join a business and everybody will acknowledge, and this is true, you know, everybody might acknowledge, okay, this place isn't what it should be. We're not doing as well as we need to. Yeah, we need to change. Okay. People usually accept intellectually the need to change if things are broken, because people aren't stupid. They can see things aren't as good as they should be. So that's kind of not normally that difficult. The difficulty is A, getting people to believe, if you're the leader, is getting people to believe that change isn't just a nice to have. Change is going to happen, and you're going to be the person that's going to make it happen. So the first thing is building that belief that it's not a nice to have, it really is going to happen, and you're going to do it. And I think then that sense of, you know, okay, how do I look at the levers I can pull, and how do I make Monday different to the preceding Friday? How do I make this desire to change impact people's lives in a positive way, preferably, but impact people's lives? Because you need to break people out of one set of behaviors and start to encourage new behaviors. So, I mean, like, it's not a seating plan. I just think seating plan is an interesting example, because actually, in reality, as a leader, you like to think you're playing a big part in everybody's lives. But I mean, in an organization of any size, you might take up, like, if you're the CEO and there's 400 people in the company, and that's not that big a company, let's be honest, but a 400 people company, you might take up 2% of their brain in a given week, because they've got all their own shit to deal with, right? You're miles away. You're up there and you send an email and they read it and they go, oh yeah, okay. And then they've got to go on because the client's shouting at them. What you've got to do is you've got to find ways to stretch out into their lives and impact their behaviors. So, and I think people really get wound up about where they sit.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it can wind people up, but I tell you what, people pay attention and you need to find a way to stretch out and get people to pay attention. And I think as long as you're able to explain to people not just why change would be a good thing, most people go, yeah, sure, I get that, but also why that change is in their interests. What's it back to this? What's in it for them? You know, it's going to be kind of hard work and it's going to be uncomfortable, But this is where we're aiming for. And if we get there, you know what? This is why that's good for all of us. Then I think you've got more chance of getting people along for the journey.
No, I definitely agree. And it makes perfect sense in terms of taking action, which is another thing that you talk about. And it's really nice to be distilled, because I worked with a business psychologist a long time ago in a different business. And he had actually said to me, and I've been quoting this ever since, a suboptimal strategy implemented is better than an optimal strategy not implemented. Well, which then just seemed to resonate with when you said take action. It's just like, that's exactly what he was trying to say. But you were basically saying, taking action trumps everything, and you put the equation in and basically said, times it by action, if action's zero, no matter what you've got in terms of strategy, whatever else, and that really made me think, that's a very good point, actually. And that then leads on to what you were saying about, if you making the wrong decision or not taking the decision is worse than making the wrong decision. Just talk to me a bit about that, because most people would think, I'd rather wait till I get the right decision.
Well, I think what I feel about that is that, first of all, the way, I agree. Since I wrote the book, I've simplified that equation. Now I think leadership impact equals clarity multiplied by action. So for me, clarity is all those things, strategy, vision, values, stuff that you write down, basically. It's important, but unless you multiply it by action, it's just words. The way you take action is you have to take, big part of taking action is taking decisions. That's how you get stuff done. And I think a lot of people in leadership positions, my example I use is driving. Okay. So it's a bit like driving. You don't often meet people who admit that they're not a very good driver, right? But if you go and spend half an hour on the M6, you find out there's a lot of bad drivers. And I think it's the same with leaders and decision making. You're never going to meet a person in a leadership position who admits to being like indecisive, but we've all the time, worked with people who are indecisive. And it's first of all, not only does it undermine your ability to get stuff done, and therefore ultimately will lead to failure as a leader, I think it is also incredibly debilitating working for somebody like that. I mean, if you're in a leadership team and you are unable as a team to reach decisions, it's incredible how quickly that erodes your confidence as a team. So I've been part of leadership teams, and we've met every week as leadership teams do or whatever, and we talk about the same things every week. Okay. And lots of people find themselves in this position. And so you're very clear what the issues are. We talk about it every week, but nobody ever quite gets to the point of saying, and this is what we're going to do about it. And I think the consequence of that is that I think leadership is about being able to, you can't control everything. There's always going to be tons of things outside your control. But what you have to be able to do is you have to be able to essentially steer your course despite that. And so the question is, are you able to steer your course despite the external noise, or are you allowing events to dictate to you? And I think effective decision-making is the way you steer your course. Ineffective decision-making or lack of decision-making means that you essentially are a kind of cork on an ocean. And you're just a kind of, you're just going to get pushed hither and thither by forces outside your control. So it's the way you take control of your environment and your situation is by effective decision making. Now, for me, a decision, what is a decision? Well, a decision for me is a choice that you take with imperfect knowledge of what the outcome might be. Because if you have perfect knowledge of the outcome. So if somebody comes up to you and says, hey, Hakeem, if you turn left, it's going to be absolutely brilliant. You're going to win the lottery and da da da. If you turn right, it's going to be a total disaster. It's not a decision, is it? I mean, it's not like you're going to go, oh, wow. That's not, that to me isn't a decision. A decision is a choice you take when you aren't clear what the outcome will be. Now, of course, you use your skill and judgment to hopefully get more right than, that more go in your favor than against, let's say that. But when you're making choices with imperfect understanding of the outcome, it's inevitable that frequently things are going to play out in ways you don't expect, which, by the way, doesn't always mean, you know, that's why I try and avoid getting right and getting wrong, because I think a lot of real world things don't ever end up being as binary as completely right, completely wrong. Yeah, it's more, yeah, that's kind of moving us. Did that decision we take move us on average a bit closer to where we want to get to? Or did that decision that we took move us a bit further away? I mean, that's a more accurate way of thinking about it. But what is for certain is, if you aren't taking decisions, your action is zero, your impact is zero, and you fail. I mean, that's for sure.
And I think that, yeah, that's very, very clear. And I like the new clarity times action, actually, because even simplified it further. And I guess that taking action is part of that is your mentality. And you talk about that in terms of your psychology, because if you are terrified about getting further away from your path, then you're not going to take a decision, because obviously, although you are still drifting, you don't realize you're drifting.
Yeah. But I think also as well, I think Jeff Bezos or somebody like that talks about one-way doors and two-way doors.
Yeah.
And you know, most decisions that we take, and we take decisions, all of us take decisions all the time, right? Most, not all, but most are actually reversible and relatively easy to reverse, right? I mean, I can think, like I said, back to this thing we were talking about earlier about, you know, when I did get made CEO, we set about sort of taking action, and we did some stuff that really, really, really worked, and that really moved us forward and really made us very different as a business. We did some other stuff that we were like, holy crap, that's a disaster. I mean, you know, we should never have done that. Now we understand why that was how it was. Quickly put it back together. And so that's what we did. You know, we weren't afraid to say, whoa, no, hang on. You know, that was a terrible idea. Let's regroup. And I think that is the case a lot of the time, but I do think that taking decisions is how, as a leader, you have to be able to control. You know, I imagine it's like being a boat, being in a boat. Okay. So you're in a boat, you're in a sailing boat. And if you're in a sailing boat, you know, you are affected by current. You know, the current is taking you in a certain direction, the wind direction changes. You know, in a sailing boat, you can't just say, here's my start point, there's my end point, I'm going to go in a straight line between those two points. Okay, you kind of zigzag around. But if you know what you're doing, on average, you know, even if you're zigzagging around, you're going in the right direction, irrespective of the fact that these other forces around you are outside of your control. The wind, the current, the tide. Yeah. That's, for me, is what leadership is. And I think the failure to make decisions, the analogy in my mind is you become like a cork. You know, you just become like a piece of driftwood in the ocean. So the winds, the tides, the currents, they're still there. But now you have no control over your direction. You are entirely at their mercy. And I think that for me is how leadership works. And that for me is how the sort of decision-making process works.
Yeah, I mean, I say something to some of my children all the time in terms of, you know, you can't affect your environment, but you can affect the way you interact with that environment and how you let it make you feel and how you then do things moving forward. So, and effectively, that's what you're saying leadership is how you affect that environment and keep yourself on the course as much as you can.
Yes, I do think that is the case, and that's. And, you know, and sometimes, you know, sometimes we talk about failure. I mean, sometimes the best leaders, the most accomplished people fail, you know, it goes wrong. And I think, certainly I can only speak for myself. I mean, I can't speak for other people, but, you know, when that happens, that is horrible. I mean, you know, and people talk about, you know, people like talking about failure, right? They like, you know, they like hearing about all the things that went wrong, but But quite often, nearly always, in fact, when we talk to people about failure, we are talking to people in positions of relative success who are talking about failures in the past tense.
Yeah.
And I think it's kind of very easy to talk about failures from a position of relative success and when they are in the past. But when you're in it and when it's happening to you, it is horrible, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, and I think that's that you asked me why leadership is difficult. I think that's one of, amongst many reasons, I think that's one of the reasons it's difficult, because, you know, because sometimes, well, maybe one of those people who's incredibly lucky and, you know, life just all plays out in front of you. But let's be honest, not many people have that experience of life, however they appear, you know, and when it's happening, it's hard. And I think that's one of the things that makes it difficult. I did a podcast. By the way, it was an unexpectedly fascinating conversation with Anthony Scaramucci, who was Donald Trump's press secretary for 10 days.
Yeah.
And honestly, he is a fascinating guy, and I'm not going to attempt to summarize it, but for anybody listening, he is not who you think he is. It's absolutely fascinating. Anyway, he talked about getting fired after 10 days, and he said, you know, he said, I got thrown out onto Pennsylvania Avenue and it felt like I'd been skinned alive and rolled in margarita salt, you know, and right. You know, and cause I mean, that's about as public, you know, that's about as public as it gets. Right. You know, it's hard.
Yeah, so just a couple more questions, because yeah, sure. We're coming to the top of the hour. So one thing that I noticed in the book, and this isn't about leadership, this is just mine, that you wrote in the female person. And I've never, and it was really interesting because it jolts you. And yeah. I'm just wondering, why did you do it? Because I was reading that thinking, well, there's no reason why I should be surprised by this, but I am, because everyone always says he, him, and you would say she, her. So what's the reason for that?
I think to get that response.
Mm.
I like the idea of playing with our preconceptions of all of it. I mean, partly because I wanted to challenge our preconceptions of what a leader was, and because mostly when not always, but mostly in the book, when I refer to somebody else, I'm referring to somebody in a leadership position. That's not always the case. So I started therefore thinking, well, why, if I'm writing a book called No Bullshit Leadership, you know, I want to challenge our preconceptions of what leaders look like and who leaders are. And I think one interesting way of doing that is to refer to, when I refer to somebody in a leadership position, refer to she, her. And then from that, I think I extended that into, well, I'm going to use that through the book. But I think my premise is that I, not only do I think a lot of what we are told and sold about the subject of leadership is bullshit. I mean, that's why I've got written a book called No Bullshit Leadership. But I also think that, and I think I feel this more, in a sense, more strongly since I wrote the book, actually, the more I've talked about it and thought about it, I feel quite strongly there isn't a leadership type. You know, and I think that's quite, and some people disagree with me on that, by the way, and some very well-informed people disagree with me on that, and that's cool too. I mean, like, I, you know, I'm not a social scientist, so I can't give you a load of, like, you know, I can't give you a load of experimental proof of that. But my belief is that everybody, given the right tools and the right tuition and the right guidance and opportunity, and they have to bring something of themselves, you know, and hard work and willingness to learn from their heart, their part of the bargain, if you like, I think everybody can be a leader. That's not to say that everybody, that's not to say that are some people more suited to it than others. Yeah, sure. But that's true of everything, right? I mean, that's true of if you take up a musical instrument or if you take up a sport or anything, you know, but I think everybody has the capability to be a leader. And certainly everybody has the capability with the right guidance to improve their leadership skills. So I want it. So I think that runs against the grain of what most of us are told and what most of us believe. And I think that's one of the reasons why I used she, her, because I just wanted to challenge some of our preconceptions around, you know, as you say, our kind of unconscious biases of what we think about when we think about leaders.
Oh, and it definitely works, because it did make me, I think, probably first or second page when you first used it. I think, oh, and you do start thinking about, right, so why is it that this is making me think? Yeah. But it does make you think about, actually, it's true, because they're not all of this type. They could be they're a massive rainbow coalition. So just on that, and this is the last one. So what would be your one key take home for people listening to this? If people are coming on here thinking, right, this is about leadership, what do I need to know? What would be the one key thing you'd want to leave people with?
I think it might well be that point. I mean, that we just covered. It's interesting, you know, again, you've asked me two questions. I've talked, as you can imagine, the book came out 3 years ago. I've talked about leadership a lot in the last 3 years. And you've asked me two questions that nobody has asked me in all the conversations I've had. And that question about the she, her, nobody has asked me. And I think my passion about the subject is that all organizations, like I say, whether they be businesses or whether they be charities or public sector or whatever, I think all organizations have challenges all the time, right? All the time. And my belief is that whether you're a school, a hospital, an advertising agency, a factory, if you find a problem in that organization, if you peel away the layers of that problem and you get to the middle of it, I think leadership ultimately is always the problem. It always ends up being about leadership somewhere. And therefore, the only solution to that ultimately is better, more effective leadership. That's my fundamental belief. And I really profoundly believe that everybody can lead. And I think not only does a lot of the bullshit around the subject kind of just obscure the subject, and so wiping away that hopefully enables people to be better leaders, but I think a lot of what I call in the book the leadership industrial complex, you know, the people that are selling billions and billions and billions of, you know, dollars of leadership training courses, business schools, I think they actually create this sense of a secret and a kind of an untouchable knowledge that I think actually inhibits people in leadership positions from fulfilling their potential. And I think excludes loads of people across society from believing that leadership is something that, you know, that they should and can and ought to aspire to. And I think that would be my outtake. I think all of that is bullshit.
And I'd definitely agree. And I'd say to anyone who's listening to this, if you are thinking about going on a leadership course, before you do it, go and buy the book. Yeah. Read through the book first, because you'll probably find 99% of what you need in there before you go and spend hundreds of thousands or tens of thousands on a leadership course. And I know also, Chris, you've got a podcast, so I suggest that you go and listen to that. And there's obviously some good references in the back of the book. But Chris Hurst, author of No Bullshit Leadership, thank you very much. It's been a very pleasurable and informative hour.
I've really enjoyed it. Thanks so much for having me on.
Thanks very much.
It's really brilliant to have real thought leaders onto the show that challenge conventional thinking. That's definitely what Chris did on this podcast. And to be fair, ever since reading his book, No Bullshit Leadership, it really has made me think differently about how to approach the topic of leadership. More importantly, it's helped me speed up transformational change by cutting through some of the bullshit that often surrounds leadership. The two things that really stood out for me from the podcast were, number one, the formula for leadership impact, i.e. clarity times action, and Chris talking about the fact that without action, you might as well forget everything else. And then number two, you know, the Peter Drucker quote, culture eats strategy for breakfast. Now, if you got half as much out of this podcast as I did, then you've just spent a really productive hour of learning, and I hope that you appreciate that gift to yourself. Now, don't forget to check out the show notes at www.thesalesaccelerationformula.com. And as you know, I always say, if you liked what you heard, give us a positive review. And if you didn't, then please keep it to yourself. Keep listening and keep growing.